Hello and welcome to Hindsight, Sharon Davis with you. The title of this weekly history program, the word hindsight, suggests that the past is something we look back to see. And much of history works exactly that way, peering at the records of times gone by in order to get a picture of the past, to render it visually. But seeing is only one way of experiencing, imagining a time, place and context. And in the past 20 years, a new school of history has emerged which uses sound as the key interpretive tool. Today we put an ear to some of the work of Australian historians whose explorations into sound history and sonic archaeology take us to the slave plantations of 19th century North America and to the exploratory expeditions of colonial Australia. Hearing the Past is produced by Jennifer Bowen.
Once upon a time, people spoke in distant voices and listened with invisible ears.
I don't know what my earliest memory of sound would be.
I think the first sounds I can remember hearing would be my parents' voices.
The sound of the pin dropping on my father's record player, and we had to sit, you know, back from it so that we didn't disturb it.
Clarity, diction, meaning, truth.
Well, I was brought up in the country, so noises were, thinking about it, more colourful.
Water on the rooftop.
Just the wind through a cypress tree that was in my front yard.
The milk cart coming early hours of the morning.
Let us determine the facts about sound and hearing.
People have always been interested in sound. Medieval philosophers discussed sound. They were interested in how sound was propagated, how it was generated, the physiology of listening.
Sound is heard in air, and also in water, though less so. Aristotle, De Anima, Book 2, Chapter 8.
There's a continuity in the interest in sound among contemporaries, but historians have been relatively slow to pick up on the interest in the role of sound in the production of history, partly because I think there has been a long-standing assumption about the power and the authenticity and authority of the eye.
In any given language, there are different levels of auditive sensitivity. English has a relatively low level of auditive sensitivity. In English, most forms of knowledge and opinion are framed in visual terms. So we might call something a reading, even though it's actually a piece of music. Perspectives, visions, all of the words that we use for knowledge, or reliable or respectable knowledge, are likely to be expressed in visual terms. Words that express unreliable information, on the other hand, are nearly always expressed in sonic terms. Gossip, tittle-tattle, chatter, whinging, rumour, lip service, scolding, nagging, prattle, Chinese whispers. All of these are telling us that we do not have a high respect for sonic information.
We're having to search around for new words as we write the history of sound, most of which are kind of piggybacked on to visual metaphors.
My name is Shane White. I'm a professor of history at the University of Sydney, and I work in African American history.
Shane White has used in his work both written records as well as tape recordings. Of particular interest have been a number made in the 1930s, part of an 11th hour project in America to save the singing and speech of former slaves.
I frequently collaborate with another historian associated with the history department there, Graham White, who is not related to me at all. It became strikingly obvious to us that because it was illegal for slaves to learn how to read or write, black culture was designed to be spoken out loud. the whole thrust of it was towards sound. So we thought it would be interesting to look at that, not just look at the obvious, which is music, and everyone today is aware of the extent to which everything from rap, hip-hop, blues, jazz, in part derives from the African-American past, but also the sounds of other things. What the sounds of the plantation were like in the South, what the sounds of urban living were like. Slavery starts in America in the 17th century, and this classic period of slavery that today is best known through Gone with the Wind is 19th century slavery. In the 18th century, slavery is hugging the eastern seaboard, so the main places are Virginia and South Carolina. In 1793, with the invention of the cotton gin, there's this cotton boom that spreads out across the South from South Carolina and very, very rapidly spreads across as far as Texas. And this becomes the plantation South. There are millions of slaves. Again, we have the Gone with the Wind image of a huge plantation with, you know, 200 slaves on it. That was relatively unusual, only a few like that. Most plantations were rather small, you know, 8-10 slaves. There's the sounds of work on a plantation. The hollers in which they called out to one another in the field were very, very expressive, even though there were no words in them. The sounds of horses, the sound of livestock, and the sounds of everything from the, you know, the blacksmith shop to the agricultural sounds of, you know, cutting sugar cane or bringing cotton in, putting it in the cotton press. And then there's the sounds linked to slavery itself, the sounds made by the whites. The sounds of whippings are the most obvious things that have come down to us in slave memories. The sounds of a whip cutting into flesh and the screams of slaves. And with that, you could include things like the sound of hound dogs. Hound dogs are associated with chasing down runaway slaves.
Slaves were whipped, they were branded, they were beaten. But oddly enough, and interestingly enough, that particular representation is something that enters the abolitionist dialogue.
Mark Smith is Professor of History at the University of South Carolina. He's led the way in the study of sound history, particularly with a book called Listening to 19th Century America. In it, he argues for the significance of the ways, the contested ways, in which the North and South heard each other prior to the Civil War.
The abolitionists in the North, their intention was to abolish slavery. And one of the things that they picked up on was the sounds of punishment, the sounds of cruelty. And in their abolitionist tracts, beginning in the 1830s, they not only visually described the cruelty to slaves, but they really played on the acoustomology of cruelty. And one of the reasons that they did this is because at the same point in time, the North was moving away from physical punishment. They were establishing prisons. And one of those prison systems was called the silence system. And the silence system was designed to silence prisoners, a kind of penance, so that they had to hear their own sin. There were a variety of silent system prisons in Philadelphia and Boston where prisoners could hear only themselves. The guards would walk around with slippers on. The pipes connecting the different cells were wrapped and swaddled in sound-absorbing material. So when the abolitionists hear the South, what do they hear? They hear backwardness. They hear barbarity. And they hear it principally in the form of slave whipping. And they also hear it in the form of slave chains. The clank of the chain is a very powerful metaphor. And in fact, some abolitionists, when they were talking in the North, would begin their speech to the abolitionist audiences by asking for quiet and then loudly dropping a chain onto the stage. And they would say, that is the sound of slavery. So what we have are two different societies, partly a product of different political economies, that use sound to accentuate difference, that use sound to denigrate the other.
October the 1st, 1844. After having repaired some harness, and after my companions had completed their arrangements, we left Jimba and launched buoyant with hope into the wilderness of Australia. Many a man's heart would have thrilled like our own had he seen us winding our way round the first rise beyond the station with a full chorus of God Save the Queen. Ludwig Leichhardt, 1844.
Sound is a profoundly cultural or social construction. People respond to sound according to the historical context that they're in.
Diane Collins is Associate Dean at the Sydney Conservatorium of Music. She's undertaken research on the way Australia was experienced in sound at various times in the 19th century. On the goldfields in one study, in another, the oral experience of colonial explorers.
When Europeans first came to Australia, assumptions about sound were part of their cultural baggage, just as assumptions about table manners or attitudes to God were. They hear natural sound often through their religious perspective. They hear bird sound as an expression of divine order. They listen to cows mooing, and they hear social calm. They're very familiar with certain acoustic environments, and it's very unlike what they discover when they arrive in Australia.
We distinguished, during the rain, three different frogs, which made a very inharmonious concert. During the evening and the night, a short, bellowing noise was heard, made probably by kangaroos, of which Mr. Gilbert stated he had seen specimens standing 9 feet high. Ludwig Leichhardt, 1845.
Expeditions, when you start reading explorers' journals, become very vivid acoustic as well as visual journeys.
Among the reeds between the two rivers was a shallow lagoon, where swans and other wildfowl so abounded that, although half a mile from our camp, their noise disturbed us through the night. I therefore named this somewhat remarkable feature Swan Hill. Thomas Mitchell, June the 21st, 1836.
Well, there's a certain amount of literal reporting, but there's often a very metaphorical aspect to the way explorers use language about sounds. You often see this with bird calls, for example. You have Sturt in the Macquarie Marshes. He's battling his way across it. He hears the incessant tone of birds and frogs, and the way he interprets it is full of metaphor because he hears it as protest, an invasion of the sanctuary of these animals. Similarly, kookaburras calls. He doesn't find the kookaburra's laugh amusing. He finds it mocking that the bird is commenting on his misfortune.
At 7 miles, as we entered a forest, we heard the sound of the natives' hatchets. I thought it best to proceed quietly on our way. We heard calls in various directions. Thomas Mitchell, January the 8th, 1832.
Was sound actively used by explorers? Was that something that they would deploy in particular ways?
Yes, one of the obvious ways they used it is that conquest itself was voiced as well as mapped or written. When John McDill Stewart, for example, on each occasion when he reaches the centre, when he reaches Northern Australia, his party celebrate this moment with three long and hearty cheers. Explorers use this kind of acoustic gesture to control and claim the land as they move through it. They also use sound to envelop them in a kind of security. For example, expeditions took dogs along with them to alert them to any kind of intrusion in a camp. The animals on expeditions have bells attached to them. They tie bells to the stirrups of their horses so they could hear where each member of the party was. They protect themselves by using sound, and the most obvious example is gunfire. They use gunfire in many encounters with Indigenous Australians to intimidate them. It's much more the sound of the gun, the report, which explorers rely on.
I drew up the men in line and sent up a rocket, and the men gave three cheers, and all the blacks ran off. They hailed us afterwards from the wood, saying they were preparing to corroboree and inviting us to be present. We heard something like a beginning to the dance, but the hollow sounds they made resembled groans more than any sort of music. Thomas Mitchell, 1832.
Slaves understood the power of the herd world. The power of maintaining silence at particular moments in time. So, for example, when they would escape, they were very careful not to make noise. They were very careful to do it at certain times of the year. Winter was often hard to escape in because sound travelled farther. For lots of the enslaved in the South, the most powerful forms of resistance were non-audible. And I'll give you an example here. Slaveholders were very anxious to control the sonic soundscape of the plantation, and they didn't want slaves, after working hours, to be doing anything other than resting to work for the next day. And yet slaves had their own cultural imperatives, and they wanted to, for example, pray. So you have accounts from the slave narratives, evidence from slaves themselves, that they would sometimes hang wet blankets to be prayed into, thereby smothering the sound. And there was these very interesting examples of slaves praying into upturned pots, and pots that are half full of water. And when I first came across these examples in the slave narratives, I couldn't quite fathom what they meant, and I thought that initially it might have been mere superstition. So I did take the initiative, and I wrote to a chap at the Institute for Vibration Studies at the University of Southampton in the UK. He said, I suspect what's happening is that any sounds uttered into the pots would not be absorbed necessarily, but they would be thrown out in a more random way so that a hearer at a distance would hear something, but he wouldn't hear necessarily the human voice. It might sound more like a rustle, the sound of a tree, perhaps. In other words, it's a kind of masking effect. And we don't know how slaves knew this, how they understood this, but it crops up sufficiently in the slave narratives to suggest that they understood something about how to manipulate the soundscape of the plantation south to engage in worship without being heard and thereby not being caught.
On many of these plantations, blacks outnumber whites, and so the sonic landscape is filled by black sounds.
Because slaveholders were accustomed to what they liked to perceive as a very powerful form of mastery, this mentality extended to the sounds that were made on plantations. So they would encourage, for example, singing while slaves labored. This reinforced to slaveholders the conceit that slaves were in fact happy, that they were docile, that they were good laborers, but they were being taken care of too.
What does a slave owner want? He wants slaves who are doing work. And if they want to sing to one another, that's fine, as long as they work. And particularly when some of the songs, like work songs, actually help with the work, then they're quite enthusiastic.
No matter where they may be, or what they may be doing, indeed, whether alone or in crowds, at work or at play, ploughing through the steaming maize in the sultry heat of June, or bared to the waist with deft hand mowing down the yellow grain, or trudging homeward in the dusky twilight after the day's work is done. Always and everywhere they are singing. Daniel Robinson Hundley, 1860.
Much of our knowledge of African-American culture, in particular music and singing, comes from travellers who went into the South. They would often be from the North or from Europe, England, France, and it was the genre of the traveller account, and there are hundreds, in fact thousands of them published covering the period from 1800 down to 1860.
The man standing on the pile of firewood sang an improvised song in stanzas. The others joined in vigorous chorus.
It was the call and response pattern that was one of the things that many of them noticed, in which there's a call and then a response to that. So often when you have a group of people singing, there's a leader who calls out something and then the answer comes back musically. And this call and response pattern comes from Africa. In the 19th century, they're using English when they're singing it, but it is clearly derived from Africa, and it's familiar to many people today through blues and, to a lesser extent, jazz.
The whole scene was so accordant that it would have produced a fine effect upon any theatre whatever. Frederica Bremer, Mississippi, 1850.
In actual fact, I think it's probably a minority of whites who appreciated the sounds. Probably more common was a response of horror, that the sounds were barbaric. This could often lead to whites just shaking their heads and refusing to accept that there is anything in what they're listening to.
A strange, weird tune no white person's voice could ever follow. The odd turns in the throat, slurring or wavering between flat and natural. Incomprehensible, meaningless, monotonous, endless chants. Obscure syllables recurring constantly.
A white is after clear singing and a linear story. That's not important to the African Americans who are listening. They're listening for other things. They're listening for verbal dexterity, cleverness, playfulness, and rhythmic complexity. But for much of the period of slavery, I actually do think that in the case of music, there were different ways of listening, and the slaves and their owners are often listening for different things.
My Country by Dorothea McKellar. The love of
Well, for an historian who's used to looking for evidence of what things look like, it's a new thing. It's something you really have to make an effort to do, to actually be aware of what things sounded like. If you're on your lookout, of course, you can find a lot of things in all sorts of evidence that aren't there for people who are asking different sorts of questions, I suppose. So it's a matter of asking the right sort of questions. What did Australia sound like? What were the things that struck people most about what the country sounded like? You can't answer those questions if you don't ask them in the first place.
Professor Alan Atkinson of the University of New England. He's written extensively on Australian history, increasingly on the sounds of everyday life and the voices of everyday people.
The first noises really that regulate social life in the settlement in Sydney were military noises more than anything else. The tattoo, for instance, the drum beats, which marked the beginning and end of each day and periodised the military life. We didn't have church bells, for instance, until, I don't know, perhaps the 1810s, 20s. Some of those sorts of noises, which are civilian noises, if you like, which are less familiar than the military noises to begin with. It's a military soundscape, I think, in that first 10 or 15, perhaps 20 years, until the free settlers start to come in, the clergy start coming in, and the regularities of civilian life, of village life, begin to overtake the regularities of military life. Settlement begins in 1788. The numbers of children born in the 1790s, increasing numbers, of course, and by the 1820s you have something like the sort of numbers which can sustain a kind of jargon, a language, certain kind of habits of speech, an in-speech, if you like. You can see that characterising the native-born by the 1820s, the native-born being recognised by the kind of words, and not only the kind of words but the kind of accent they used as well. It's a kind of medley of convict-type language, particularly London Cockney language with Aboriginal words in it as well, and you can see this strangely jumbled kind of language. It might well have been a put-on kind of language to some extent, with native-born trying to show off their own distinctiveness by using certain terms. There was a certain kind of pride about being native-born, so that may well be that just as they wore certain things like cabbage tree hats, etc., they also used a certain sort of language in order to demonstrate they were native-born.